Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the House Committee on Transportation Policy, Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. My apologies for the delay. On our agenda today, we're going to go out of order a bit, and the first public hearing that I would like to open is on House Bill 2596. And Mr. Walker, could you tell us a little bit about this bill, please?
Chair McKeown, members of the committee, House Bill 2596 decreases the vehicle registration fee for a truck tractor used exclusively to tow travel trailer for personal use. We have not requested the revenue or fiscals on this, and there are no amendments.
We need them back. And I would like to call us, since I can't read this, I'm going to have
Eric,
Tim read
try
this.
Those. What did you?
I thought you had your glasses.
I would like to call up Mr. Watkins and Amy Joyce, please. And, of course,
oh,
Representative
you.
Olson. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Olson, State Representative out of the Albany area. Almost started to say the Albany Patrol Office, but that's been a while back. So anyways, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify before you regarding House Bill 2596, which is brought to you from a constituent in Albany, Jack Clark. Unfortunately, Mr. Clark is not able to join us today in person, but you can find his written testimony on OLIS. House Bill 2596 addresses the use of truck tractors from commercial use versus personal and or recreational use. Currently, there is no distinction between the two uses, and thus an Oregonian using a truck tractor for recreational use is still required to pay the same amount as a commercial tractor vehicle. To provide some background, in 2003, the fee was $215. In 2010, the fee was increased to $438. Dollars, which is clearly an increase of well over $100. Most Oregonians using a truck tractor for recreational use are RVing and are on a fixed income. Appreciate Amy Joyce because she's been deeply involved with my legislative assistant, Abby Weekly, in crafting this, where we've been going. We've been at it for probably well over a year. Although this bill would impact a small population of Oregonians, this is a common sense policy, I feel. There is a photo, if you noticed, that's actually what we're after, that right there. And that's pretty, there's not that many truck tractors out there designed just specifically for RVing like that. Rex here is a good friend of mine from Albany, too. He has some issues as well. He gets this, and he has some concerns, too, maybe at another date and time. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
All right, Rex Watkins, Albany, Oregon. A little background. I come from a log trucking family, and this is something I wanted to do for a long time. We had as I mentioned in my the paper with the four photos and then the language down below, we had a 1995 F-350 dually. It's a one-ton crew cab pickup that we'd put a flatbed on, and when the kids' ATVs were small, it worked fairly well. When the ATVs got a little bit bigger, it didn't work so well, and most of the trips, they weren't white-knuckle. I've been white-knuckle pulling a big travel trailer with a half-ton pickup. The dealership said it would work, but it's certainly not something you'd want to experience. Coming from a trucking background, this seemed like a natural extension, and when I looked into the market to find something bigger than the one-ton, F-450, F-550, F-650, you could find, or the FL-70s, which is a small, medium-duty truck from Freightliner, which is the picture that Andy showed you. International makes crew cab trucks like that. Those used and beat to a pulp with literally no life left in them were running $35,000 to $40,000. I came across this little Kenworth for $12,000, and it seemed like an easy jump. When I went to the DMV to license it, having seen several trucks in Oregon, some like the FL-70 and campgrounds, some of the guys had personal plates on them, like you have on your car. And I said, how'd you do that? Well, I just went to their local DMV office, and that's what they said I could get because I wasn't going to use it for commercial use, put not for hire on it. Well, I have not for hire on my truck, and when I took it to the DMV office 3 years ago, they said, that's a truck. I said, yeah, that's not how we're going to use it, though. I'd like to get a personal plate. Can't. Okay, well, then what can I do? Well, it has to be licensed as a truck. You can choose between PUC, which is a lower registration fee, but then you pay per mile, or you can license as a truck and go under 26,000 pounds. And I told the guy, I said, well, you know, the truck weighs 14,000 pounds, so about double what you'd get in a large crew cab, long bed, diesel pickup. And I know I'm going to haul between the quads and whatever else I might put on the back for a camping trip, maybe 2,000 to 4,000 pounds. So maybe you license it for 20. And he says, well, yeah, but if you license it for 20 and you happen to carry more than that for something, then you're going to get a ticket. So I license it for 26. Cost me almost $600 a year per year to license that truck. So I can pull my travel trailer. I can pull a quad trailer down to the sand dunes, the picture you see there. We used it for a trip to Canada pulling a drift boat. The weight of the vehicle is not excessive for the class that it's built. It was, when it was originally licensed as a truck, it was licensed for 52,000 pounds. But that was to pull a 32-foot box trailer that the guy was using for a business that he had. Our insurance company requires us to convert the truck for personal use. So it can't be used for a commercial truck. It still has air brakes. I don't have the problem with the CDL requirement, but I'm required to change the use, which means to take off the fifth wheel plate that you would use for a regular truck and set it up for RV use. So we've wired it for RV trailer. And there's a lot of people in the industry. This is really common more on the in the Midwest and East Coast, although we're seeing it more and more and more on the West Coast. With guys repurposing older trucks. Some of them are antiques. They still want to drive them. Some of them came from the trucking industry, and they just are comfortable in that cab. The power output in this truck is the same as what you'd see in any other medium-duty truck, like the Internationals and Freightliners that I'd mentioned earlier. So, you know, for us, it was a no-brainer because we almost doubled our fuel mileage compared to the gas engine that was in the Ford. We have a vehicle that's way more capable of handling the load that we want to pull. essentially as much room inside the cab as we do with a regular crew cab pickup with the sleeper on the back. So we would love to see a reduction in the registration fee. I would like, for my personal self, I'd like to see it go more than just travel trailer, but that's not the issue today. If we can get started with that, that'd be wonderful.
Ms. Joyce?
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. The bill calls for these vehicles to be registered at $55 per year. The way DMV would is looking at implementing this would be to issue a truck plate, or what's commonly called a T plate. So I want to call out, I have an error in my written testimony. I will, after committee, submit corrected testimony. What I indicated in the testimony was that normally truck tractors would have a heavy plate on it, heavy truck plate on it. They wouldn't. This is the same plate we issue for this weight class. So it would be the T plate. The way, again, the DMV would implement this is basically a self-certification, that people would come in and sign a form that DMV would create that they're only going to use this for personal use. The potential issue with that is self-certification. There's no really way to verify. And since all the other trucks of this size and class are running with the T-plate, there's really no way for law enforcement to know when this truck tractor is running down the road, whether it's being used for personal use or not for personal use. They don't know what somebody paid for the registration. Registration in Oregon is based, the philosophy of it is it's based on weight, and it's based on the idea of the relative damage to the road that's done by smaller vehicles, passenger under 8,000 pounds, and then there's that breaking point at 8,000 and over that. It's really about how much damage is being done to the roads, and that's how for decades the registration fees have been set based on that philosophy. Also to note that with the fee structure today, without this bill, folks are allowed to register quarterly. So, for instance, if you're only pulling your RV in the summer months, you could only register in the summer months and get that fee reduction. If you're only using it once or twice a year, you can get a very inexpensive trip permit. So those are some ways to reduce the fee. But we do have concerns about potential fraud. There's really no way to potentially enforce this since the plate is the same.
Ms. Joyce, have you seen an increase in these requests? I believe we've had this bill before us in previous sessions. Are you seeing an increase in requests for this change? And do you have a sense of how many there may be? How small a number are we talking about?
Chair McEwen, I'm not aware of other requests for this specific item. I don't think DMB would have a method really to keep track of these kind of one-off type requests. So I don't know a number. I haven't heard that it's been a thing that people have been asking for.
Okay. Vice Chair Vial.
Madam Chair, I'm particularly persuaded by the higher safety and lower cost of your transition to a little bit bigger truck. But I'm wondering how Trooper Olson would respond to Amy's observation about the difficulty of catching folks that maybe were trying to do this fraudulently.
Yeah, so Madam Chair and Vice Chair Vial, great question. Wouldn't be any different than what we used to do with members out on the road when they were dealing with farm plate issues. Because what you have to do on those kind of situations is inquire and do some digging. And it wasn't that there wasn't times that I ended up finding misuse of farm plates on a regular basis, but you got to end up digging to do that. Again, that's a small arena, the farm plate issue even. But this would be, I believe, smaller.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amy, Ms. Joyce, is there a potential or possibility to alleviate the potential for fraud by just somehow coming up with a recreation vehicle type license plate for these trucks, especially if they're going to and as I see the potential in the future, a lot more folks retiring, seeing this as an opportunity for a recreational vehicle to somehow transition this as a possibility without potential for fraud, because I agree, I don't want law enforcement to really have to pay attention to that. Just they can see this plate, it's a recreation vehicle, et cetera, and let them go down the road, unless you're unsafe, right?
Chair McEwen and Representative Meek, interesting question in that when DMV looked at this bill in prior sessions, the way they first analyzed it was, this is sort of a new thing. Let's come up with a new plate and a new system. That in DMV's world of an ancient computer system, that's quite an expensive proposition to do, to create a whole new sort of plate type for essentially a new type of registration. And so the idea to go with the existing T plate was an effort to keep down the expense, which often drives policy decisions in this building. So I mean, I think ideally for DMV and for the fraud issue, it would be a completely different plate type, but that becomes very expensive. And so the idea was, if we did a tree plate or excuse me, T plate, it's quite a bit less expensive. But there's a trade-off.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Do these T plates have a sticker that they have on them that shows what year they expire, et cetera?
Chair McEwen and Representative Meek, I believe they do.
Because my question is thinking outside of the box, reprinting new T plates, maybe we can come up with just a sticker that costs us, $4 to put onto that plate to say this is a recreational vehicle now.
Okay.
And the gentleman, sir? Ms. Joyce, would you
finish up, please,
yeah,
and then we'll go on.
Chair McEwen and Representative Meek, as with all things in the world of DMV, it's not quite that simple. Yes, there could be a different sticker, but it's not an issue of just printing up some different stickers for a couple of bucks. That's a controlled inventory. There's a system to keep track of the inventory, so it's bigger than just spit out a roll of tags that we'd use on these particular things. But that is potentially a midway solution.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Watkins?
Yes, thank you. The trucks in other states that do this have to have on the side of the truck. If you look at mine, you can see the logo. It's kind of hard to see if you don't have your glasses. But where it says Watkins in the middle, above that it says not for hire. Oh, in other states, a truck that is used for recreational use has to say not for hire. If somebody was hauling a payload, it would be obvious they were for hire. If it had not for hire in the truck, and then they were using it for commercial use, they could be cited pretty easy. Some of the other states require it to say RV use only. So those are those put the burden on the user and not on the state. You can still use your truck plate, your truck, or stickered in this case. Graphics are amazing these days. The ability of law enforcement to come up and see, well, this guy's got not for hire inside of his truck, but he's pulling a cargo trailer or large car trailer. We see those guys sometimes using these size trucks to pull car trailers that are five or six cars, or like a private car hauler, or they're using them for hauling cargo trailers, large number of cargo trailers. That's obviously a commercial use, and they could be cited. But if they're just pulling one trailer, travel trailer, or in our case, you could see people using this to pull very large boats. There's some boats get pretty heavy at the 8.5-foot width, which is still legal to go down the road without a special permit. Trucks like this could really help those people. It would give them another option as opposed to the F-550, F-650, or the small internationals. But if you just put the RV use only or not for hire like we have on ours, we had it just for fun at the bottom because it was sort of a fun way to people look at it. But those kind of identifying features would take care of that problem as far as I'm concerned.
Thank Trooper you. Olson, is that could you weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I do find that rather interesting, and yes, that could very easily help.
Representative McLean.
Oh. That actually answered my question, because I wondered why we couldn't just write something on the side. So sounds like a good idea to me.
Vice Chair Meek.
Yes, Ms. Joyce. So the question would be then, is the potential if we could come up with an amendment that says that if a truck is for a personal use, we have a certain font size that they have to use to put this, not just in calligraphy or whatever, not for hire or a recreational vehicle, or I think not for hire, something more specific would be more professional and easier to identify. But that help alleviate and put the onus on the operator and not the state?
Chair McEwen and Representative Meek, I think that idea goes away toward addressing the fraud concern. Of course, it does not address the issue of the weight of a truck is the weight of a truck, and the registration system in Oregon is set up to classify based on the damage it's going to do on the road. So there's nothing to be done about that issue.
Vice Chair Meek.
Well, thank you, Ms. Joyce. But if I'm understanding, most of these commercial vehicle trucks are on the road a lot, probably continuously. And if I'm looking at a recreational vehicle, it's probably going to be used several times a year, maybe even 15 or 20 times a year. I think having to do the special permit when you want to be flexible and, hey, kids, just get in the car and go, it's going to make it more difficult to have to go down and get that permit. So I think I'd like to see if we can somehow accommodate a system like this and allow families to have another option. But I don't think that maybe the fee, $55, is not enough. Maybe we can kind of work with that, because I know that they are heavier, but we have a lot of heavy, you know, RV vehicles out there too.
Representative Beretta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, along what Representative Meeks was saying, what is the weight of one of these tractors, and then how does that compare to like a motorhome? And then a motorhome as far as what the license fee is on a motorhome annually?
I don't know what a tractor weighs. If you want to,
yeah, ours weighs 14,000 with the deck that we put on it, the flatbed on the back. When the truck was empty, Some guys use these, and they put a fifth wheel, an RV-style fifth wheel plate on the back, which doesn't weigh much. They might have a little bit of decking around it. Sometimes they do a lot of toolboxes. It depends on what they do, but your FL-70, your International, the F-650 crew cab, we see a lot of those. Those are licensed trucks because they weigh more than 8,000 pounds empty. That typically you're going to run in the 10 to 14,000 pound category. You're going to see most of them single axle, like the truck we have here. That's single axle in the back. So there's only one set of drivers, but you're going to have dual tires in the back. Your contact patch is quite a bit bigger, and that's the area of the tire that contacts the road. So the weight per square inch is typically less than what you're going to see in an F-350, where even a single F-350, where they're pulling a very large fifth wheel. Those will have as much as 3,000 pounds of pin weight, which is where the fifth wheel attaches to the truck, and all that goes on the rear axle. There's no way to spread it like with a bumper pull with equalizer bars. So guys, with those pickups, what they end up having to do is they airbag the suspension in the back to give them more capability of handling the weight. In my opinion, they tend to overload their bearings and such in those axles, but you know, they're pulling it, they can decide. So from my perspective, I understand the damage issue, and I know that, but we're not loading these vehicles to 80,000 pounds like a commercial truck. You've got a 14,000-pound truck. You've got a little bit more square inch of tire patch on the road to help spread that weight out. We're pulling anywhere from 6 to 10,000-pound bumper pull trailers. The fifth-wheel trailers can be 10 to 20,000 pounds, but still we're looking at a maximum combined vehicle weight of somewhere between 15 and 35,000 pounds, which is quite a bit less than a commercial load. People will use these same style trucks also for hauling horse trailers, which are fifth wheel style. Some of the horse trailers have person space in them, so you could use them as a front as an RV and the back as horse. I have several friends with those kind of vehicles. They pull them with 1-ton pickups because that's what they have, but they always say, if I put in more than four horses in there, I'm overloaded. So
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we're going to have to move on. We have a very full agenda this morning. Is there any other quick comments or questions before we wrap this one up? All right, thank you very much.
Chair.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2596. And I should make an announcement. Yesterday at 8 o'clock, we posted that the Vision Zero bill would not be heard today. I apologize for any inconvenience this may cause. I understand there are some people that are here, but that bill will not be heard today. So my apologies if that created some inconvenience. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2083. And ask Mr. Walker to give us an update here. Has to do with tax credits for transportation projects.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2083 extends this sunset for tax credits for transportation projects from January 1st, 2018 to January 1st, 2024. The tax credit includes alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure projects and alternative fuel vehicle projects. This bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you. Chris is here. So Chris Alanek.
Mr. Alanek, would you like to join us in case there are technical questions for you? There may likely be, sir. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural, natural gas utility, serving the Willamette Valley coast and the gorge. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this morning. We recognize the state has a revenue issue and the need to consider whether or not to consider tax credits, and we fully support that process. Natural gas is used in light, medium, and heavy-duty trucks. It helps the state meet its goal for clean transportation fuels. There is a new natural gas engine for heavy-duty trucks called a Near Zero, which basically gets you down, reduces 90% of the NOx emissions. That is coming into the market, just was kind of approved for, I think, about a year or so ago. Northwest Natural actually runs about 100 of our vehicles on natural gas to help us meet our goals of providing cleaner options. We also are under kind of a requirement to kind of clean up our greenhouse gas emissions. That's one way as a utility we can do that. CNG, compressed natural gas, is what's used primarily in vehicles. It requires a fueling facility that compresses the natural gas generally on site before it's placed into a vehicle. The tax credits do help reduce that those costs. Currently, there is not a ubiquitous fueling system within the state. So generally, these are done at return-to-base fleets. So if you're a delivery company, our vehicles, for example, trash haulers, things like that, are basically the types of folks who are currently using compressed natural gas. We are working on a piece of legislation to ask the Department of Energy to look at what's called renewable natural gas, and that's basically the waste gases off of wastewater treatment plants, landfills, dairy digesters, et cetera, that we could then clean up the methane from that, clean that up, and put that into our system, make it pipeline quality. And that, too, can then be put into the transportation sector. And that has a very high environmental value from a transportation standpoint. So we would just encourage you to move this bill down to the tax credit committee where it could be looked at along with all the other tax credits. Thank you.
Questions? Is there anybody else that would like to comment on this bill while we have almost a full house today? I think that's probably wise, Mr. Walker. Chris, would you tell us just very briefly what the tax credit actually does? I'm sorry I had to step out, so I wasn't aware of Mr. Bauer's testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. The tax credit funds basically two different kinds of what are called transportation projects. You have the fleet vehicles, and then you also basically have the refueling stations. And the tax credit is 35%. The tax credit equals 35% of the certified cost for the project, and it's claimed over 5 years. So it's front-loaded. So in the first 2 years, you have 10% claimed in the first 2 years and the 5% in the following 3 years. And so it's basically just those two. That's the core nature of the tax credit.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2083. And I think we'll go to House Bill 2293 and open a public hearing and look to Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2293 updates the Oregon statute to standardize fuel tax penalties and ensure appropriate taxation of exported fuel. Sunsets a waiver of fuel tax from the sale of biodiesel derived from cooking oil. You have in front of you a dash one amendment, and this amendment replaces the bill and sunsets the fuel tax waiver on January 1st, 2018, and strips everything else out of the bill.
Oh, and we have, I think what I would like to do first is call up Leah Horner, Daniel Porter. Let's start there. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Leah Horner with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I first want to thank you for hearing House Bill 2293 this morning. As Mr. Walker indicated, we are asking for a consideration of the Dash 1 amendment, and I believe I had the opportunity to chat with each of you or your staff about what that does, which is replaces the original bill with really just Section 9 of the bill, which is the early sunset for the B20 biodiesel tax credit program that we are currently operating. When we as an agency bring forward legislative concepts for consideration through the legislative process, we take into consideration a number of factors, but a couple of factors that really rise to the top for us are things around cost cost savings, cost recovery, and efficiencies. This bill really rose to the top for us around cost savings. The B20 program was one that passed in 2013. The original revenue estimate of loss to the state highway fund of the lifespan of the program was $4.6 million. To date, we've seen a revenue loss of over $11 million. And if the early sunset does not go into place, we'll see a revenue loss of over $30 million to the state highway fund. So really, we bring forward this bill purely out of a revenue loss to the state highway fund, looking for a way to kind of shore up our revenue sources, especially as we're looking forward for a funding package. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Porter.
Okay. So, good morning, Chairman Kuhlman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Daniel Porter, an economist in the Department of Transportation. So I'm here to really just talk to the revenue impact piece of it. As Ms. Horner said, the bill that created this program was House Bill 2435 that was passed in the 2013 session. And what it does is that for a gallon of diesel that's sold at a retail station where the 30-cent state gas tax would have normally been paid, that is waived if that gallon of fuel is blended with at least 20% biodiesel from used cooking oil. So it was called like the French fry bill or something at the time. So the revenue impact, as Leah said, that at the time it was passed, the impact statement was that it would be about $4.6 million loss in fuels tax revenue over the six-year life of the program, which ran from January of 2014 through January of 2020, January 1st, 2014 to January 1st, 2020. So and what's happened is that it's been actually much more successful in that. And as Leah said, through kind of the first 3 years of the program, through January, really, we have the most recent data. We've got $13 million loss in revenue. And as she said, with the current forecast, the total loss over the six-year program is just over $30 million. This is revenue that's apportionable, so it will be shared with our cities and counties. And what our amendment's trying to do is accelerate that sunset by 2 years, so taking the six-year program to a four-year program. And by doing that, our expectation is that we would save almost $12 million in fuels tax revenue. So that's why I bring it to you this morning, is because the difference there is a lot larger than what was expected at the beginning. And that's with that. We'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could get your perspective on why the bill in the first place and what the original bill back in 2013 was meant to accomplish, and accomplish it for whom.
Chairman Kieran, Representative Wilson, I think that's a good question. I think that there are a number of opponents behind us that could talk probably a little bit better to what marketplace this was meant to incentivize and the genesis of the original bill.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. The first is just I'm a simple guy, not great on math, so I need help here. You're saying this tax credit was too popular.
That is essentially correct.
Okay. Second question is, in your analysis, you're saying it's a loss of revenue, so there's been absolutely zero, no economic benefit in terms of jobs or creation of activities or creation of markets. This has been a net loss in every category. Is that what you're saying?
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Evans, that is not what I'm saying. I'm strictly speaking to the loss in the fuels tax revenue. It is not saying anything about whether or not how the industry is developed through this tax expenditure program.
The follow-up on that is that you're looking at one half of the equation, not the other half.
We are looking at, again, I am speaking just to the revenue section in this.
Thank you, Phil.
And I think I would just draw attention to the fact that
Ms. Horner and Mr. Porter are looking at, I think, this from the perspective of their agency.
Understand.
Which I would
and I respect
commend that. Them for. And yeah, I just want to make sure that we're clear that this that they're doing their job here. Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, yeah, I don't want to pile on, but I was just also wondering if any economic impact had been done that you're aware of, perhaps even by an outside source, on the folks that sort of relied on the program and the term of the program in terms of making investments and creating markets. Has any of that been done?
Chairman Kuhn and Vice Chair Vile, I think some of the other folks that are going to testify would probably be best to speak to that in terms of maybe what the business impact has been for them. We haven't done any specific study on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Porter, just a quick, you're an economist, hopefully you know some of these numbers. What percentage, if we lose an additional $16 million over the next couple years and let this sunset naturally the way it was written, what percentage of loss compared to the full, you know, transportation budget are we looking at? Is it less than 0.5%?
Yeah, Chair McKeon, Vice Chair Meek, it's a very small percentage. If you look at state revenues are annually over $1 billion, so it's a small overall percentage.
Okay, I'm just curious. I want to see what kind of follow-up, Madam Chair. Yeah,
yes.
Just wanted to see what type of, you know, pull or loss we're really looking at.
Chair McKeown, Representative Meek, just to tag on to that, I would be remiss if I didn't add that our highway folks yesterday reminded us that this revenue loss would pay for two retrofits of bridges. So I just throw that out there as a frame of reference.
Thank you.
Representative McLean.
Well, I want to equal up the conversation a bit here. It's a situation where, again, I think we've got two folks sitting in front of us who are trying to do their job. They're basically bringing to us some information, and they're asking us to look at this information, which we should be doing on a regular basis on any tax credit. And I'm, you know, really looking forward to hearing the other speakers, but thank you for coming and doing your job today.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call now Tyson Kiever and Lila Leathers, please. And then on deck, we'll have Mr. Tyree and Mike Mercer. Welcome to our committee this morning.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Do you want to? In any order you choose.
Go ahead.
Chair McKeown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tyson Kiever. Thanks for having us here today to speak about this. I've submitted written testimony for the record. I'm going to try and stay on script as best I can and speed through it so I have time for questions.
And if you submitted in written form, if you could just summarize, please, because we have
absolutely
more work. Thank you.
Absolutely. And it is short written testimony. The long and short of it is our business is Sequential. I'm co-founder and CEO of the business. We've been operating in Oregon in the garage since 98, as a business since 2002. The state of Oregon has been very, very good to us. We participated in multiple programs that I consider us a success story of our industry, the clean fuels industry, the biofuels industry, the replacement transportation fuels industry, and an emerging growing business, no longer a small business. We employ over 250 people today, 150 of which are in Oregon, and we are the longest running biodiesel producer on the West Coast. This particular program caused us we made significant investment after this program came into play to make it biodiesel more available throughout the state. We faced many barriers to entry, such as misperception about the use of recycled cooking oil as a viable fuel versus other virgin-based fuels, as well as the traditional distribution infrastructure is very hard to penetrate. As an example, Kinder Morgan is a large terminaling facility in Oregon, and they charge over 15 cents a gallon just to have our product get into the distribution fuel shed. This bill helped incentivize more distribution blending racks, a terminal that we've developed here in South Salem at our biodiesel production facility, a terminal space in Portland, distribution delivery assets, training all throughout the state. This fuel is available all throughout the state. Oregon is a leader with about 25% or over 25% of the B20 and higher blend pumps in the country, and it's largely due and thanks to this program. Our investors, our shareholders, have made a significant investment. Lots of our partners, suppliers, distributors, retailers have made an investment in this program, and we've bear that cost on the front end of the program, and we'd like to see it stay the course.
So, Mr. Kiever, I guess my question to you is, how are you going to plan out for the next 2 years if this tax credit is extended for the tax credit to actually end in 2020?
We've planned our business around, Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, we've planned our business strategically with long-term planning all along the way. I'm hesitant to mention some of the programs we've participated in because of the scrutiny among them, but we have participated in the Small Energy Loan Program, a SELP loan. We are in full compliance, mm-hmm. and that is set to sunset into 2019, which coincides with the expiration of this bill in January 2020. Number two, the Clean Fuels Program has a nice ratchet that continues to escalate over time, which is very front-loaded with credits being generated early in the program. We are a good jumpstart to that program. By the time this sunsets, the Clean Fuels Program ratchet is set to take some of the transition there. We're hoping by that point our customers are more used to high blends of biodiesel. There's more confidence with original engine manufacturers and higher blends of biodiesel, and the marketplace is more familiar with the fuel. And the distribution infrastructure has been more tried and trusted and more miles on the road, which would help us continue moving forward without it.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us, Chairman McEwen.
Thank you.
members. My testimony also has been submitted, and I would just like to say that my son, my daughter, and I run Leathers Enterprises, and we're...
I'm sorry, ma'am. For the record, I'll need you to identify yourself.
Lila Leathers Fitz, and my son, Brent, and my daughter, Catherine, and I run a company that was very hesitant to step into this unknown field because, as you know, people who use diesel, they use one kind of diesel. They don't deviate. So we helped to promote the loss in the agency that was just before us by going out and creating a card that when a customer came in, we could give them this card and educate them on what the biofuel does for the economy and for the good clean air, let's say. Anyway, we have that we gave to every customer that came in, and some of them probably got it more than once. And then in the winter, we had another card that would tell them that since the biofuel, the B20, gels at a higher rate than your regular diesel, it told them what to do to avoid the gelling and whatnot. Anyway, we were basically the first marketer to go into this program with more than one site, and it took us about 6 months before we really signed on with Tyson and Company, and we're located. We have now sell B20 and 21 of our retail sites, including Medford, Burns, John Day, Central Oregon, Hermiston, and the Portland metro area. And we've invested approximately $25,000 in each of those sites, average, and that includes the new dispensers, the piping hardware, and one new tank, and the. Since the customers didn't understand this, we did quite an extensive education of our staff to help educate those folks. The tax incentive has been critical to get these folks into the station, first of all, to buy the product or even to ask questions on it. And when we signed up for this, we anticipated that the program would run its full term. And we've passed the tax savings on to the people because that's what the legislature intended to do. And our pump prices are normally 20 to 25% less than a lot of street prices and the B5. Beyond the economic implications, B20 is becoming a viable option for consumers' diesel vehicles, and it would be a shame to lose the momentum that we've built up. And perhaps one day, it's our belief, the lower cost incentive to sustain this will pay off. And please allow us to educate and provide for our customers. Thank you.
And ma'am, I'll ask you the same question.
So
your business plan does factor in the fact that this tax credit will end in 2020.
Yes, it does.
And you're planning for that, so there will be no expectation that it would be extended beyond that.
No, we think that one thing I had in mind was that this would help lower the costs of some of the other programs that possibly could be put into place to keep the air clean, because I feel we contribute a lot to that. So.
But when this tax credit ends and your prices creep up, this is factoring into what your plan is to be successful after January of 2020.
I'm sorry. The state forgives the 30-cent a gallon tax credit. Mm-hmm. So at the end of this program, we realize that the state, we will have to charge the 30-cent tax credit. Does that answer better? Mm-hmm. Because we will be charged. We'll have to pay the state also the 30 cents.
I guess what I'm trying to avoid is in a couple of years a plea to extend the tax credit beyond 2020. And I just want to make sure that this is planned for.
Okay.
If this does extend to 2020 as opposed to ending in 18.
Okay.
Am I asking that correctly?
I think.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Barreto, yeah, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, right now you can sell this at a reduced price because you don't charge the tax.
Right.
So you're trying to get people to use it. In 2 or 4 years, you're going to have to increase that, and people are going to have to make that decision on whether they buy this or go back to the standard diesel. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're hoping they'll be used to the product and that they'll like the product and that they'll continue buying it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate
Thank you
being
you
here
much.
Today.
Thank you.
Mr. Tyree, Mr. Mercer, and Mr. Huntman, we've got about 12 minutes. We need to move on to autonomous vehicles.
That's right.
We're glad you're here this morning. Thank you so much for traveling up.
Thank you. Oh, excuse me.
In any order you choose, please.
Want me to go? Okay. Madam Chair McEwen and members of the Transportation Policy Committee, thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. For the record, my name is Ron Tyree, and I'm president of Tyree Oil Incorporated, based in Eugene. I want to state my opposition to House Bill 2293 with the -1 amendment, which advances a sunset date for the biodiesel tax exemption to 2018. Tyree Oil and other Oregon small businesses have made significant investments to participate in the market created by the Oregon biodiesel tax exemption. Our company alone has invested over $500,000 in equipment to transport the biodiesel to rural areas of the state where it was not widely available prior to the exemption's introduction in 2014. Our investment was made based on the state's assumed assurance that the exemption would be available through 2020, up until 2020, giving us ample time to generate an investment or return on that initial investment. Anticipating the question in advance, yes, at the end of the current planned exemption, our capital will be amortized and we'll be in fine position, and you won't see us coming back asking for any kind of an extension. But allowing the exemption to expire early does weaken our investment, harms our family-owned business. It takes away one tool that helped develop and promote clean fuels in the state of Oregon and all the other benefits that come with increased employment and et cetera. We believe strongly the state should honor its commitment by keeping the biodiesel tax exemption in place until 2020 as originally intended. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tyree. Mr. Mercer, welcome.
Madam Chair McEwen and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Mike Mercer, and I run a consulting business in Portland, Oregon. So I work with quite a few business leaders and entrepreneurs who are involved in the clean energy kind of transition. And there are also businesses that are looking to do the right thing in terms of running both a good business, but being good stewards of their employees, the communities they're a part of, and the planet as well. So as you know, there's considerable risk for businesses to take on kind of new investments and manage their risk. And so they're looking for as much certainty as possible. And I think we've heard from others, and we'll probably hear from others to come, that have looked at that risk. They've also looked at the kind of the certainty on the end side of the 2020 expiration. But so I'm here really to ask that you maintain the B20 tax exemption until 2020 when it's slated to sunset. I think you know that there are considerable potential impacts if we were to sunset this early. One is, what message does it send to other businesses in the state when they're looking to make investment on using some sort of tax credit from the state of Oregon? And they see the example of where it has been sunsetted early. That doesn't provide a lot of confidence for them to make that investment in the future. I think we're also really on the cusp of some pretty significant strides towards moving towards a clean energy future, not just here in Portland, but around the country. And so this is not the time to step back. And then lastly, I think we've heard a bit in terms of there's businesses that have made significant investment. Jobs are to some degree at risk, as well as the investment that has happened for the state of Oregon. And we'd like to see that continue to be supported, at least through 2020. So I ask you to stay the course through 2020. This program's working very well. And thank you for your time and service.
Thank you, Mr. Mercer. Mr. Honeyman, good morning.
Good morning. Chair McEwen, Craig Honeyman, Lee of Oregon Cities. I'm here to support the Dash 1 amendments on behalf of Oregon's 241 cities and to provide more information. This is not a commentary on the B20 program, to follow up ODOT's message that this program has exceeded expectations. The city's share of the $30 million that is lost revenues will be $6 million if the program runs its course. And with, in the aggregate, cities being upside down $217 million in street budgets every year, we just wanted to provide this information to you and for your consideration. Again, not a comment on the B20 program, just how it impacts cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one thing. The B20, what is the price on the B20 versus the standard fuel right now at the pump? I mean, is it more than 30 cents? The 30-cent tax credit, that's being relieved there, does it make it equal in price to the standard diesel, below or above?
It's typically running at about that 30-cent difference.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. To the industry representatives, thank you. I appreciate you being here. And I think the last thing that Oregon needs to do is to show itself to be an unreliable business partner in this case. So I will commit myself to do whatever I can to keep that sunset exactly where it is.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today. Is there anyone else who wants to speak to this bill? Seeing none, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2293. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3119. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 3119 will establish a procedure for automated vehicle manufacturer to submit certificate of compliance to the Department of Transportation, describes the requirements for automated motor vehicles, and permits operation of an on-demand automated motor vehicle network. We have no revenue or no fiscal impact statements issued. We're ready to go.
All right. Well, committee, we're entering a new world. And I would like to call Mr. Lightsey, Mr. McPherson, and Quinn Webb, please. Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Lightsey, we'll invite you to go first, please.
Great.
Thank you for traveling here today. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman McEwen, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Harry Lightsey, and I'm the Executive Director of Emerging Technologies Policy for General Motors. It is certainly a privilege to be here today to talk to you about this very important bill. General Motors is a strong advocate for state policy that would pave the way for self-driving vehicle testing and deployment in Oregon. We believe that legislation should encourage and foster innovation while also ensuring that safety is the top priority. Self-driving cars have the potential to offer many benefits to our communities. They provide an option for those who cannot or choose not to own or operate a vehicle. Self-driving vehicles will make it easier for people who do not have access to mass transit, and they will open up new economic options by expanding American mobility. While self-driving cars bring many benefits, the most important benefit we see and stress is safety. Nationwide, almost 40,000 people died in 2016 on our roads and highways in America due to car crashes. And well over 90% of those deaths are caused by human error. Self-driving vehicles can save lives. At General Motors, we are committed to a safe transition to self-driving cars. And so we have focused on developing a suite of technologies that range from active safety features to fully self-driving vehicles. Our innovative technology in our cars today provides many safety features, including full speed range adaptive cruise control, lane keeping assist, forward collision warning, and collision mitigation braking. But before we deploy self-driving vehicles at the highly automated levels of autonomy, we need to gain experience in a safe environment. That is why it is vital that legislation is enacted to provide for the safe testing and deployment of self-driving technology. We believe there are three main issues that the legislation must address. First, without changes to state law, it is not possible to make progress on self-driving cars in Oregon. Current laws clearly contemplate a human driver in the vehicle, making it impossible to test and deploy these vehicles here, and that is why action is needed. Michigan and Arizona are leading in the deployment and testing of self-driving cars because they took action. Second, putting safety first should require meeting certain capabilities. The Oregon bill before you prioritizes safety by ensuring that participants can produce safe vehicles that comply with federal and state safety standards and have the financial wherewithal to be accountable for the safety of their vehicles. I want to be very clear about this. General Motors supports an open and competitive marketplace for self-driving cars. We are not opposed to any company or any type of company developing this technology. And we support public policy that is open to the marketplace. But we do believe that all participants in the market should stress safety as their top priority and should be accountable for the performance of the systems that they put on the roads in our public. The last thing the public needs, or frankly supporters of self-driving technology need, is a do-it-yourself tech lab retrofitting non-autonomous designed vehicles with unproven technology. Third, passing this bill would foster competition because it sets the parameters for safe testing and deployment of self-driving cars. For example, these cars should be required to meet all traffic laws. By setting safety as the standard and by inviting all industry participants to meet that standard, the bill creates the type of environment that is best for the public. If I could go briefly through the bill, there are certain features of it that just to call your attention to. So the first section of substance is the definitions, and these are all definitions that are being standardized quickly within the industry based on the definitions of levels of autonomy by the SAE, and also based on the issuance of the Federal Automated Vehicle Policy Guidance by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The second, Section 3, clearly states that a manufacturer or person may operate a vehicle, a self-driving vehicle, on the roads and highways, and this is a very important authorization. There are certain requirements here, and frankly, General Motors is willing to discuss the requirements. We are aware that certain stakeholders have expressed concerns that some of these requirements may be too prohibitive and may stifle innovation. That is the last thing we would want to do, and we are certainly flexible in terms of discussing with the committee and with other stakeholders what types of requirements are appropriate in Oregon. Similarly, Section 4 lays forth some vehicle requirements. These are based on laws that have been passed in other states. But once again, if the feeling is that some of these are too restrictive and could stifle innovation, we're certainly willing to discuss those provisions. Section 5 discusses the fact that, at least initially, the rollout of these vehicles was envisioned to be within bounded geographic areas. Once again, that has been criticized by certain stakeholders as being too restrictive, and we are certainly willing to discuss whether that should be a requirement or not. The Section 6 deals with data collection. And frankly, there are abundant requirements both at the federal and within the state of Oregon with regard to data collection. And we could have this provision in the bill or not determined based on how the stakeholders feel about it. Section 7 specifies that you can operate an on-demand motor vehicle network with self-driving vehicles. GM certainly sees that the near-term deployment or testing of these vehicles will be within fleets of vehicles operated in ride-sharing networks. This is where the technology is, frankly, and also where the business opportunity is that makes sense for the early development of these vehicles, and we fully support this provision. Section 8, which is, again, extremely important, makes it clear that with regard to following the rules of the road in Oregon, the computer system that is driving the vehicle, or the automated driving system, it is, as it's called, has all of the requirements that any human being driver would have under the laws and under the rules of the road. Section 9 just simply deals with a liability provision of the manufacturer that states that if someone alters or changes a vehicle made by a manufacturer without their consent, that the manufacturer wouldn't be liable for anything that resulted as a result of that modification. And the rest of the bill is largely just conforming changes that make clear that within the provisions of the rules of the road, which require or anticipate a human being driver being behind the wheel, that these provisions would not apply to self-driving vehicles. Finally, just to call your attention, there's one additional section, Section 15, that speaks to local government preemption. And the concern there is frankly, that in the early stages of the deployment of the vehicles and testing of the vehicles, that there could be created at the local level a patchwork of inconsistent requirements that would make it very difficult to maneuver these vehicles through our communities if they were required to have certain things with regard to one community and a whole different set of requirements with regard to an adjoining community, and they were in the process of providing rides between communities, that could make it very difficult. But once again, General Motors is certainly willing to work with other stakeholders to come up with a satisfactory arrangement with regard to this provision as well. That concludes what my prepared testimony, Chairman McCune and members of the committee. And I thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to discussing this further with you.
Thank you. Since we seem to be going a bit different direction with the rest of the testimony from what I see on the witness list, I think what I'd like to do is open questions for Mr. Lightsey first. Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, I mean, this is a very extensive bill, and, you know, I have like 15 questions, so I'm not going to ask them all this morning. But there was one thing that you said. You had one of your representatives in my office probably a month ago, and one of the sections you talk about is boundaries. And what that individual indicated was that, you know, you basically were going to be taking, you know, the sensors and the cameras were going to be taking, you know, pictures of that 7-mile route. And then during that, you know, that very initial, you know, type of testing, that it would be only on that route because you realize that things can change and, you know, the geographic elements can change. Stoplights could be out. I mean, there's a number of things that are there. So try and sort of scope in a little bit on that wide-ranging kind of boundaries that you were talking about here versus the limited 7-mile testing route.
Right. So as I indicated, we believe at General Motors the early opportunity for the testing and deployment of these vehicles is within fleets that are owned by General Motors. That way we can ensure that the technology is up to date constantly. We maintain the vehicles and are therefore accountable for their safe performance. And we think that will occur within ride-sharing fleets in urban centers and metropolitan areas because that's where ride-sharing demand is. But within that area, we need to be able to provide the service that customers would want to be able to get them from point A to point B. And we don't know exactly where point A and point B is going to be in a community, so it won't be on prescribed routes generally. However, if there are concerns, what we would like to do is work with the local communities as to where and how these vehicles are allowed to operate. So, for example, if a community expressed a desire to not allow these vehicles to be operated, at least initially, on residential streets, then we would certainly work with them to comply with that discussion. So,
can I follow up on that? Because
follow up.
The deal is that when you're talking about it, you're talking about it as a test in one light, and then you're talking about it as a commercial endeavor in another light. If you've got customers, and now you're trying to get from, you know, A to B or any place any customer wants to go. So is it a test or is it a commercial activity?
Thank you very much, Chairman McCown, Representative McLean. Yeah, so we think this technology is progressing very rapidly. We have over 50 test vehicles currently in San Francisco, California, Scottsdale, Arizona, and Detroit, Michigan area. And we are testing these vehicles every day. And the nature of the technology is that every day that you're out there on the public streets gaining experience, seeing the types of situations that you encounter on the public streets, the vehicles get smarter and better in their driving. And so we are seeing this technology develop very rapidly. We are, as indicated, we are testing, and right now we have a human being behind the wheel. So even when the vehicle is in a self-driving mode, there's a human being that's there that if the vehicle encounters a situation that it can't deal with, the human being can take over. But we envision that in the not-too-distant future, we will be able to establish to our level of confidence that the self-driving vehicles are performing better than human being drivers. And when we can establish that, when we have the data to establish that, with a full degree of confidence, it is our plan to remove the human being driver from the vehicle. So that is the plan. As I indicated, we think that ride sharing is a great way to expose customers to the technology because they're not thinking in terms of a major purchase like a vehicle purchase, but they are thinking in terms of getting from point A to point B. And that is a whole different equation in their minds. What we see today is that I think overall the public understands that there's a tremendous opportunity for safety here. The public understands that automatic driving systems, self-driving vehicles, won't be distracted when they're behind the wheel. They won't get behind the wheel when they're drunk. They won't get behind the wheel when they shouldn't be behind the wheel. They will be fully aware, 360 degrees of awareness around the vehicle at all times. And so the opportunity is there clearly for these vehicles to perform much better than human being drivers, which frankly many of us have always said we had a teacher that had eyes in the back of their head, but I'm not aware that there are really anybody that I know of that really does have eyes in the back of their head. And so there are just inherent limitations that we all know that, that we have as human beings, and that is why well over 90% of crashes on the road today are the result of human behavior. And so, you know, the potential is there for overall safety, but when you talk to specific persons and say, are you ready to get in a self-driving vehicle? The answer that we hear from the public is, I'm not ready to go there yet. And so we have a tremendous job to do to convince the public that this technology is safe and it's reliable. And we believe that offering them the opportunity to participate in ride sharing is a great way to do that.
Thank you. Vice Chair Meek.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Lights. Just a quick question. As we look at this new technology and the process of this, when it comes to nothing is perfect, and so my guess is that we're going to have to recodify traffic law, et cetera, because whether it be a programming error or some type of oversight or some type of glitch, eventually something's going to go wrong and something may be violated. Who's going to be responsible for that violation and or liability? Will it just be one insurance policy? How are the communities looking at this right now?
Thank you very much, Chairman McEwen, Representative Meek. Clearly, as you indicated, no system is perfect, and we all know that even though it will our hope is that it will perform much better than human being drivers, that there certainly will be crashes. And in that area, our belief is since the manufacturer or the person that has put the automated driving system on the road, if that system is at fault under the current traffic laws, that the manufacturer would be responsible for the performance of that system. Under the current laws. Other communities, as you have indicated, have created additional requirements in terms of both individual insurance and insurance requirements for manufacturers of these systems to ensure that that they're financially have the wherewithal to be responsible for the performance of their systems.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm one of those who loves to drive, loves to ride, but I'm still intrigued with the whole idea from a public safety standpoint. I have a couple questions. One involves not picking winners and losers, and the other involves safety while this testing is going on. You mentioned, as you went through the bill, that there were several stakeholders possibly in opposition to what or had a different view. I'm wondering, because you also then talked about industry standards, and who is this industry? My assumption is it's more than just what a traditional car manufacturer is, and we have new partners involved. And is there any collaboration as to a larger view as to what this looks like either nationally or in Oregon?
Thank you very much, Chairman McEwen, Representative Noble. So we are at the very beginning of this technology, and it is tremendously exciting, and our chairman of General Motors has said we expect to see more change in the next 5 years in our industry than we've seen in the last 50. And frankly, we do have new entrants into the industry, technology companies that have not been traditional manufacturers of automobiles are bridging into the industry because of the technology that we're talking about here. And frankly, it is our position that the marketplace should be open to any of these companies, regardless of who they are, to innovate with regard to this technology. If it had not been for the innovations of Google, for one, I doubt that we would all be here today, because they really, 7 years ago, committed to the concept of a self-driving vehicle and pushed the technology very hard to get us to where we are today. So I think that allowing innovation is something that we should all support. On the other hand, we have to realize that when we're talking about vehicles on the road, public safety is a critical concern, and we have to strike the right balance of protecting the public safety at the same time.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. The statement and a question, but the question kind of revolves around concerns. I spent a lot of time in the military with some of the most technologically advanced equipment in the world, and we still miss. And there are systems that are viable for viruses, and EMPs can ruin an entire day. So my question is a follow-up from a conversation I had with one of your representatives a month ago or so. I will put my own concerns about Skynet, et cetera, on the cupboard, try to be patient with technology. But my concern is this. Will you ensure, or can you ensure, that whatever product downrange is the totally autonomous vehicle still has some ability for human override in cases where it's necessary?
So thank you very much. Chair McCune, Representative Evans. So the vehicles that we're talking about here, which are highly automated, self-driving vehicles, fully self-driving vehicles, are required by the definition of what they are to be able to achieve a minimal risk fallback condition on their own without human intervention. And in fact, other participants in the marketplace have said that allowing human intervention and therefore reintroducing human behavior and human fallibility into the equation will actually put the system at greater risk than allowing the system to achieve that minimal risk condition on its own. So we believe that ultimately where we will end up is with vehicles that are designed and built without human being drivers in the equation. We're talking about vehicles that without steering wheels, brake pedals, and gauges, other things. But we don't see that will happen initially, but that will happen in the near-term
future. Ms. Representative Evans?
The follow-up is this, that understandably, the responsibilities of industry and government are different. Efficiencies are what corporations do. That's understandable. The redundancies and the fail-safes that maybe a penny or two pennies more than adjusters can put into the system make me very concerned, because the ability of getting to a completely autonomous assumes some levels of protections that may not be financially beneficial at the time. So I'm going to ask you again. At least I think the answer is no, but right now what your answer is no, that you're not planning on having a human override capability.
I think eventually that's where we all have the vision of where this will end up. I think that, and I'd like to discuss that with you. Certainly, we understand that the design and building of a self-driving vehicle is an incredibly incredible technological task. And when we're talking about this, as you mentioned, we're now talking about building multiple redundant systems Because if the vehicle is going to be responsible and we are accountable for the performance of that vehicle, then we have, and our brand is on the line, and as we talked, certainly we have a big job to do in convincing the public that these vehicles will be safe and will be reliable and that they can trust them to get from point A to point B. So, you know, our engineers have compared the design and building of these vehicles to being more like designing and building a modern airplane than a conventional automobile. And that's simply the case, and we are certainly devoting significant time and resources in making sure that we design and build these vehicles to be as safe as we possibly can.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, and then we're going to need to move on. We have seven people also lined up, and we have 20 minutes left. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I have fortuitously downloaded a new app that goes off every time there's a traffic accident in Salem. And I had to turn the audio off because it was driving me crazy. I just have to wonder, in a world where we have perfected this technology, would my app be going off like crazy every day? Because it certainly is with humans behind the wheel. I'm amazed at it. And so, yeah, I'm very interested in this technology.
Is that a comment or a question, sir?
Is it a comment?
Vice Chair Meek.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. Has there been any research or potential programming to allow, quote-unquote, a kill switch? So if you're in the vehicle without a steering wheel, that I'm just not liking where I'm going, push the reset button, pulls over to the curb, and we can start all over? Any type of technology looking in that direction?
Yeah, so thank you so much, Chairman McCown, Vice Chair Meek. The human interface for the vehicle is going to be critically important. These vehicles have to be very intuitive in how they interact with their human being occupants. You know, this is, as we said, a brave new world for all of us, and innovation is going to rule the day. And the companies that come up with the best interface and the best capabilities for allowing the occupants to interact with the vehicle and get what they want out of it are going to be the ones that succeed in the marketplace. It's certainly our plan to allow the occupants of the vehicle to be able to end a ride at any point in time they desire, or to change the destination in the course of a ride. We think that folks will expect that capability, and we certainly intend to meet that.
I have two questions, sir, and I'd like very brief answers, if you don't mind, because we need to move on. But we've heard some feedback that this type of legislation isn't necessary and that there's currently no prohibition on testing or operation of AVs in Oregon. Is that the case?
Chairman McCown, Vice Chair Meek, members of the committee, thank you for the question. General Motors believes that the laws of the state of Oregon, much like the laws of all other states that we're aware of, clearly contemplate a human being driver being behind the wheel. There are laws that say that the human being has to be licensed, that they have to be over a certain age. These types of laws clearly do not apply when you have a computer system that is driving the vehicle, and we think that the legislature should act to remove these roadblocks and make it very clear that the policy of this state is to allow the testing and deployment of these vehicles.
And very briefly, does this bill affect the trucking industry in any way? Would it prohibit or restrict commercial truck testing or platooning?
Thank you very much, Chairman McCown. This bill simply addresses the standard passenger vehicles. It does not address the trucking industry.
Thank you. Sir, thank you very much for traveling here today. Again, we are in a brave new world. We as a state need to enter this judiciously and very carefully, of course, ultimately for the protection of our citizens. But it's coming, folks. So we need to do our best to manage it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. McPherson, Mr. Webb, and your excuse, sir, and I'll call up Mr. Powell to the third seat.
Thank you, Chair McCown, and the committee for hearing our comments today. My name is Mark McPherson. I'm with Teamsters Joint Council 37, part of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and we represent all of the Teamster members in the state of Oregon. I've been a Teamster for 38 years. I worked for our international union for 3 years. I worked for the Joint Council for 7 years, and for 28 years I was a truck driver. I brought my co-worker Quinn Webb to perhaps answer questions that I may not be able to answer. I spent 28 years driving what's essentially a route van around the communities and delivering potato chips. And I realize we're discussing not so much commercial vehicles, but we're opening up a door here, and I see it creeping into our industry as well. And I think there's no one who is greater and more experienced at driving than the Teamsters are. And we have some real concerns about driverless vehicles. Primarily, let me talk briefly about safety.
And sir, I will need you to be brief.
Okay. We have questions in terms of malfunctions in vehicles, equipment malfunctions. I have driven for 28 years. I've seen multiple times when I've had short circuits, generators go out, power supplies go out, that sort of thing. What happens in this technology if there's some sort of equipment malfunction? It happens. I'm skipping really quickly. I have a question about bad driving, poor driving conditions, and the ability of these sensors. I've driven many times in blizzard conditions, and it's almost whiteout. Can these sensors detect vehicles on the side that may be covered in snow, or pedestrians standing on the sidewalk who are covered in snow? Can it detect those sorts of things and recognize it, or in pouring rain? I've driven in horrible conditions. I know we all have, where visibility is really, really difficult. And I question whether the sensors in these vehicles can adequately do that. I'll just cut to the quick here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think the Teamsters recognize that this is technology that's coming. I think this is, you know, has a real lure to it to have driverless vehicles. I think that there are a lot of questions that I feel are very unanswered about the safety of these vehicles, and I think that there has to be a little bit more homework done on this.
I think there will be a lot of homework done.
Yeah, before
on this,
we move forward, we don't encourage this. And if I may make just one little quick.
I got 16 minutes, and I've got six
I'll
more
you
people.
That's,
thank you.
Maybe I'll be part of the issue.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Representative McEwen and committee. My name is Quinn Webb. I'm a Teamster representative right here in Salem, Oregon, out of Local 324. I represent nothing but delivery associates from Class A, Class B, Class C. No license required beyond the additional. I've driven truck in the state of Oregon. I have over 2 million miles documented in the state of Oregon alone without incident. I've never had an accident. I've never had an accident. I obtained my CDL in 1990. I have grave concerns that with the technology, we all know it's coming. I have a vast knowledge. I'm concerned about where it's going, what it's going to do to Oregon's economy in the transportation department. There's a lot of people who deliver goods that it could affect their jobs. It affects the safety of our kids. You know, can it recognize a baseball rolling out into the street? Can it recognize these things? But if you have questions, I
very
appreciate
very legitimate
you
concerns, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Powell, welcome.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm in opposition to House Bill 3119. My written testimony is available on OLIS, so I will just briefly summarize that testimony in the interest of time. Automated vehicle technology has the potential to significantly impact the way insurance products protect individuals and businesses from financial loss. And the property casualty insurance industry is a critical stakeholder in this conversation as this technology is deployed, because of the need to consider the vast array of issues surrounding coverage and liability, as well as the impact of automated technology on the general public. I will just raise concerns on two specific sections in the bill. The first is Section 6 that deals with data collection. I when I say data collection, I kind of think of it as a like the black box that we know about in airplanes when there's a crash. It is essential that insurers have access to this data in the event of a collision or accident to determine the facts of what happened and assess the liability. State Farm would support a lockdown provision that would state basically that in the event of a collision, the data needs to be locked down and saved for 30 seconds prior to the collision and at least 5 seconds after the collision or when the vehicle comes to a complete stop. The reason for that is that that is where you'll find the facts and assess the liability of an accident. So we think that's very important. Second, we think there should be a statutory requirement for captured data that would increase from the current statutory requirement of 3 years to 5 years or at least 1 year beyond the statute of limitations, and that that data should be available to any litigants in a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So that's the data collection piece. The second piece is Section 9, which attempts to exclude manufacturers from liability if the automated vehicle or driving system is modified, but it does not specify what a modification is or could be. We oppose this section because the manufacturers, technology companies, are currently working on standards with the goal of creating a self-certification process for automated or self-driving certification process for these vehicles. And at the federal level, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is still in the early stage of addressing the cybersecurity concerns around these operating systems. So without further clarity of what would constitute a modification and who is ultimately responsible in such a situation, we believe that section is likely to limit remedies available to crash victims. With that, Madam Chair,
thank you.
I will take any questions.
Very brief questions for this panel. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today. Mr. Towers, Mr. Gee, and Mr. Jones, please. Is it Gee or G?
G.
I'm sorry. My apologies. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'll kick us off. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I've submitted written comments, so I'll be succinct.
Thank you.
Or give it a shot. The first of all, we're excited about the possibilities for this technology. We want to be really clear about that, that this could do a lot to improve safety. Our members see the human impact of the carnage on the roads every day. You know, every day, and we want it to stop. And this is a big deal. And, you know, and frankly, we as stakeholders and you as legislators have a tremendous responsibility here and a tremendous opportunity to save a lot of lives. And we're excited about being part of that process. We are not interested in picking winners or losers. We like the idea of figuring out how to be innovative, especially on safety issues. To one of the comments that was made earlier, you know, our ideal situation would be to create a process through which there can be collaboration on safety and competition on other aspects in this industry. We think that's what would advance safety fastest, because what we've seen in previous situations with safety advances is there's a tremendous pressure, tremendous financial pressure to be first to market, and it makes perfect sense. But the thing is that the first product is followed by injuries, deaths, and a lot of litigation. And then the second product is much safer. What can we be doing collectively to shorten that time period so that those deaths and injuries can be reduced? Yeah, that's the role that we want to play. And finally, in talking to legislators about this bill, we asked that very question: if there are billions at stake, what's the, you know, how do we get to a safer place? And a legislator who I think is fair characterized, not necessarily a fan of ours, said that you guys are the buffer, And so we can accept that responsibility, but make sure to give us the tools that we need to help protect public safety and help hold wrongdoers accountable. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm Charlie G. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I also submitted written testimony, so I'll be brief. So I focus my practice on the representation of vulnerable roadway users, which is defined in the statutes: bicyclists, pedestrians, skateboarders, road construction workers, never an equestrian, thank goodness. I support this technology. I think this technology will help it so that the roads, by the end of my lifetime, will be so much safer in that carnage that Representative Wilson referred to. However, I'm in opposition to this bill. I think this bill does it in the wrong way. Section 15 of this bill removes local jurisdiction and lawmaking from the process. That, combined with Oregon's very progressive and safe vulnerable roadway user laws, which require subjective interpretations by a human operator through a windshield. For instance, you know, noticing whether or not a pedestrian is a child to trigger the 20-mile-per-hour speed limit zones, determining the height of a bicyclist to determine the safe passing distance, which is unique to Oregon law and a very progressive law that's been lauded across the country. Noticing whether or not a pedestrian is using a white cane or a guide dog, which indicates that they're blind and gives them a special right-of-way while crossing the street. Those are very specific instances that, you know, a robot car, an autonomous car, could be programmed to determine. But what this bill does is it opens up the state as the testing boundaries anywhere in the state, while removing local lawmaking to say, listen, we don't want you to come down this road at between 3 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon because it could be a school zone. We don't want you to drive through our main street because it's a heavy pedestrian area. So, you know, I hope that this technology advances. I hope Oregon becomes a good testing ground and manufacturing ground, but this bill is just not the right way to do it.
Yes.
Hi, Chair. Chair McEwen and members of the committee. My name is Eric Jones, and I'm a partner in the regulatory group at Venable LLP in Washington, D.C., and in that role I serve as counsel to the Self-Driving Coalition for Safer Streets. And what I'd like to do, I've submitted written testimony as well, and I understand we're under a time constraint.
7 minutes and two more people behind you.
And I will be as brief as possible. But what I want to do is just spend a little bit of time talking about what the coalition is, who are members, why the coalition was formed, and then the perspectives on state legislation, the state role, and I will go as quickly as I can. The coalition was formed in April 2016 by Ford, Google, Uber, Lyft, and Volvo. And you'll note that it's a group of companies that come from different places, right? There are transportation network companies, there are technology companies, and there are automobile manufacturers involved in this coalition. And the reason why they came together is because there's a belief in the fact that fully autonomous vehicles can lead to essentially a safety revolution. And that's why we're here today. That's why I flew all the way out here to talk to you about it, because we were very appreciative of the fact that the state's taking a look at this. You've already heard about all the issues right now with human drivers and what we could do if we took humans out of the equation. So I won't list off all the statistics there, but what I want to say is that given what we think can be a safety revolution, we are very focused on what states are doing, and we are very supportive of state efforts that encourage the deployment and testing of self-driving vehicles. But we also have concerns when state legislation will end up slowing down or negatively impacting the process that's underway. And I will tell you that I'm testifying in states all over the country right now, and a couple of my colleagues are, because there are a lot of states that are interested in this right now. It's in our written testimony, but we do have concerns with the way the bill is currently drafted, and for that reason we oppose it. And those concerns are related to the fact that we think that there are hurdles that the bill would put in place that would delay the rollout and testing of self-driving vehicles in Oregon, and put Oregon in a different place than other states, which have taken steps to encourage self-driving vehicles. And I also should say that the bill includes a number of places where it would leave rulemaking for the Department of Transportation. And having been part of those processes myself and in other roles, I know how that can go. And so that's potential for additional delays in the rollout and testing. And so I guess what I'll close with, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but just that the coalition is very supportive of the fact that Oregon is taking a look at this, and that but it's a very thoughtful effort with the legislation that was put forward, but we do have concerns with specific aspects of it, and look forward to working with you moving forward.
Thank you, sir. And I think you'll find that there's great interest on this committee for what other states are doing and what's happening at the national level in this regard. We know we're just barely tipping our toe in the water today and just getting started with a process that's going to take some time, so we appreciate your perspective and appreciate you taking the time to come.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I believe Vice Chair Vile had one very brief question for this panel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Towers, what tools do we not have as lawyers currently that we need to make sure that we keep the playing field level here?
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Vile, in terms of for the challenges that the bill imposes, I'd say one that jumps out at me is the Section 9 that says the manufacturer should not be liable for aftermarket changes. And so if a company makes a product that is easily hackable or easily modified, a 995 kit could modify it, should they cease to be responsible at that juncture for making something that can become easily dangerous? I'm worried about the interaction between the surety bond or self-insurance and existing motor vehicle insurance law. I feel like that opens a whole can of worms. We're also very, very concerned about the transparency of safety and crash data, that making sure that there's video material, that the video data is available, that the data can't be altered, those sorts of things needs to be really codified.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're very welcome. Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to call Ms. Edwards and Mr. Brower, and while we're doing that, announce that House Bill 2464 is going to be rolled to April 12th agenda. And we have one work session to go. We're very close. Thank you. And I believe we have a letter in OLIS, Ms. Edwards, that we all had a chance to take a look at. So,
that's correct, Chair McEwen. Mm-hmm. For the record, Elizabeth Edwards at the City of Portland. You have a letter from Mayor Ted Wheeler and Transportation Commissioner Dan Saltzman. So very briefly, the City of Portland is opposed to the bill in its current form because it preempts our local authority and also prematurely authorizes the widespread use of autonomous vehicles. That said, we're very excited about the opportunities that this technology presents. I think you've heard that from a lot of parties here today. Our city is actively partnering with private and university sectors to help develop best practices for testing and piloting autonomous electric insured vehicles. And here's why. If it's done correctly, you have a reduction in crashes, closing gaps between first and last mile of transit, reduced emissions. But if it's done incorrectly, it could lead to more congestion, more vehicle miles traveled, more emissions. And so we're on the cusp of something really exciting. And the City of Portland's excited to work with public and private stakeholders to craft policies to help deploy this technology. So we respectfully request that perhaps a work group could be formed so that we can work with public and private stakeholders in order to help craft policies that will advance our shared economic, environmental, safety, and equity goals. So thank you very much.
Batting cleanup.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Travis Brower. I'm the assistant director of ODOT, and I'm here before you today because I oversee the Office of Innovation within ODOT, which is our group that undertakes work around emerging trends in technology. The Office of Innovation has seen that connected and automated vehicles are coming, and so we have been ramping up our work in the last couple of years. We've hired a connected automated vehicle policy advisor. We've convened a connected automated vehicle steering team, and we think that we have some opportunity to offer you assistance in working through some of these process and policy issues that could be of assistance. I want to make the clear distinction between testing and deployment for the policy framework that you would look at. Testing is going to be a few vehicles on the road and probably can have a fairly light regulatory touch from a safety standpoint. Deployment, on the other hand, is something where you can see thousands of vehicles on the road, some of which don't have brakes or steering wheels, and I think it would be prudent to have a more in-depth regulatory framework in place when we're talking about full-scale deployment.
With this, we currently have no real statutory authority when it comes to the testing of AVs. So while there are certain laws on the books that may preclude you from driving an automated vehicle without a human behind the wheel, in terms of basic testing with a human behind the wheel, there are opportunities for that testing. And we actually are working with a number of companies today that are looking at doing this testing on Oregon roads. So if the legislature chooses not to take action, that will actually, in many ways, not preclude testing of automated vehicles on Oregon's roads. However, that would have to be done on a purely voluntary basis in working with ODOT. We would have no ability to work with a firm to, say, redirect it away from an activity that we may see as potentially dangerous. So there has been some work by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, in promulgating guidance, and there are a couple of pieces of that that we think would be valuable for the legislature to sanction. First would be designating ODOT as the lead agency for automated vehicle work in going into the future, because we have that leadership role in safety and mobility in the transportation sector and have all the most relevant transportation components, DMV, motor carrier, safety, all within the ODOT umbrella. The second would be standing up an automated safety technology committee, which is something that's also recommended by NHTSA in their guidance, that would help with coordinate statewide implementation and tackle the policy issues related to automated vehicles. The third would be to create a framework, a pilot program for AV testing that would actually be a little bit more rigorous than what we have today. We would want to work with those who want to test on Oregon's roads so that we could get information from them about their testing plans, what technologies they're testing, under what conditions, you know, weather or types of roads, a proof of insurance, confirmation they meet the federal motor vehicle safety standards and fallback plans should a driver need to re-engage the vehicle. Those are things today that we can ask a company to voluntarily provide, but we have no ability to require that. And so right now we're working with good actors, responsible companies that want to do this, but certainly there are the potential for other companies to come into this space as well. So we would be happy to continue discussions with the committee and work with the committee. As I said, we'd like to convene in this automated technology safety committee, and that could be a forum in which we could engage some of these issues, work through the various issues across state government and potentially with the partners across the transportation system, including law enforcement and other stakeholders as well.
Thank you, Mr. Brower. That was very efficiently done. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Well, this is fascinating. I think we have a start. We have a long way to go. Everybody stay tuned, and we'll see what our path forward holds for us. I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3119 and very quickly open a work session on House Bill 2922. Mr.
Chair,
Walker.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2922 increases the surcharge collected for the issuance of Crater Lake National Park registration plates from $10 to $15. One moment. And there is a minimal fiscal impact. And there is a revenue impact that has been issued by the Legislative Revenue Office indicating that there will be an increase in revenue that will go to the Oregon Community Foundation for use on Crater Lake projects of $259,000 in 2017-19 and $336,000 in 19-21.
Thank you. Vice Chair Meek.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2922 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Meek moves House Bill 2922 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Is the foundation, as the recipient of this increased revenue, a public body?
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, I'm not entirely sure how you would define a public body. I think in 2011 or 2013, there was a bill that was brought forward by Senator Atkinson to move the revenues from the Treasury to the Community Foundation because they felt that the increase in investment income would more than offset anything that the Treasury could come up with.
Madam Chair, more specifically, does the public have input on what projects are taken up by this foundation?
Just to clarify, Representative Wood, are you speaking specifically to the fund that is housed at Oregon Community Foundation by the Crater Lake National Park Registration Plate folks?
Madam Chair.
Representative McLean.
I think it's important to remember that we haven't changed anything. This is what was originally passed was the same institution or foundation that is getting this money. It's not been changed. It's just simply upping the fee because of the cost from ODOT.
I understand that, Madam Chair. My concern would be that we're increasing fees on the public who's buying license plates. And I'm wondering whether the public has input on what projects are taken up by this foundation.
I just want to clarify, this is voluntary. People do not have to purchase this plate. So
I understand.
They voluntarily can. Let me see if there's any other comment. Representative?
No, I was just going to make the same point you did.
Yeah. Okay. Is there further clarification, Representative Witt, that we could find for you?
Probably not, Madam Chair. Thank you for that consideration. It just seems odd to me that we would be increasing license plate fees without mandating public input.
I think we have the authority to do that, sir, and that's why the bill is before us.
But I'm
the
not
request.
Sure that we've accomplished that end, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion?
I guess I have. I do support this, and one of the reasons I support it is because of the idea that it's a specialty plate. It's an opportunity. It's not required. And also because it's our number one specialty plate, people love this plate. And this particular foundation has also received a lot of support from both county and city councils, and they were here to testify at the original meeting talking about how they would use those fees to even continue the projects that the public has enjoyed at Crater Lake.
Thank you, Representative McLean. That's helpful.
Any other comments, sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Ash.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion carries. Do we have
Esquivel?
Should we ask Representative Esquivel to carry? Does anyone object? All right. We'll assume that he will. If not, we will be back. And on that note, anything else for the good of the order this morning, Mr. Walker? Highlights of next Wednesday? We will adjourn in a moment.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, next meeting on April 5th we have a full agenda of a public hearing on House Bill 3125, which is related to auto cycles, House Bill 3120 related to vehicles, House Bill 3231 related to public highway projects, House Bill 2288 related to Connect Oregon. We'll have a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3118 relating to the Port of Sayus Law. And then we'll have a series of work sessions, House Bill 2463 relating to integrators, House Bill 2083 related to tax credits for transportation, House Bill 2749 related to Hood River White Salmon Bridge, House Bill 2750 related to bridges, House Bill 2293 related to motor vehicle fuel, and House Bill 2320 related to small watercraft. And I would say at this point in the session, the agendas are fluid.
And just so you are aware, we have not been holding committee meetings on Fridays. We may need to as we get towards the end, so keep your Friday mornings between 8 and 9 available as we, again, address the fluidity of how we get to our first deadline. So thank you all. We're adjourned.
Chair, thank you.
Thank you all. We're adjourned.
Chair, thank you.
First deadline.